rides a third rail. Transmit deaf styles with sign language and braille. In hot pursuit of Donald Trump rap loop. Produce what you feel with Navy SEAL Mike Troop. Sergeant SP, slaughter Pete Rock of Gibraltar. Miraculous lyrics that tread water. A rap nigga, show respect. Write rhymes that connect, collaborate. Break bread with corrupt and deck. Keep my feet blessed, fresh with the Scottie Pippen. In the game of life, I play all positions.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. What do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to Off the Hour, CKUT's community news program. This is a Tuesday edition of Off the Hour, and it is November 17th, 2009. On this edition of the program, on October 23rd, activists from the Alliance Romaine returned to Montreal after completing a series of marathons spanning 1,500 kilometers across Quebec to raise awareness and political will in opposition to a hydroelectric project that they say will endanger the Romaine River in northern Quebec. We'll hear an interview by Tom from CKUT's News Collective with Chris Scott of Alliance Romaine, who ran across Quebec as part of this campaign. Also today on Off the Hour, Honduran President Manuel Zelaya was forced into exile following a military coup in June. He's set to return to Honduras on September 21st. Thousands of Hondurans defied the coup regime's orders and gathered in front of the Brazilian embassy in Tegucigalpa, where Zelaya was in refuge. Steve Stewart was in Honduras for several days in September. In this segment, we hear Stewart's interview with the Red Eye Show on Vancouver's CFRO radio. But first off, the McGill Daily Student Newspaper brings you their weekly roundup of audio reports from the McGill campus and beyond. You are listening to Off the Hour, breaking all corporate and state-created sound barriers on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. To reach Montreal's Community News Collective or to get involved, call 514-448-4041, extension 6788. That number again is 514-448-4041, extension 6788. Stay tuned. From CKUT and the McGill Daily, this is Unfit to Print. Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Unfit to Print. My name is Braden Goyette and I'll be your host. Today we've got a particularly literary installment for you in anticipation of the Daily Literary Supplement on stands this Monday. We've got two editors interviewing Montreal poet Sina Karras about poetry and politics, and then we've got former Daily editor Simon Lucen giving an excerpt from an upcoming reading he's participating in on November 26th with other McGill grad students and professors.
My name is Amelia Schoenbeck, and I'm the Daily's coordinating culture editor. I'm here with Emilio Come del Junco, who is a production and design editor at the paper and who also writes for the culture section. And we're also here with Sina Karras, a Montreal-based poet whose latest book, Expressway, was nominated for the Governor General's Award for Poetry. Amelia wrote a piece about Sina and her work that appeared in the November 12th issue of the Daily. And right now they're going to talk a little bit about some of the issues that were brought up in that article.
Okay.
So
there's been a big change in your work over the past decade or so, and I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about the trajectory from the personal and the local to more global issues over the past, you know, 8 years, from your book Slip to the newest one, Expressway.
Okay, I think it's been a gradual process of thinking about the systems that we are operating in, under, in our society, in our culture. And I think it had something to do with the fact of my moving from Montreal to Toronto to New Jersey to Brooklyn to Philadelphia. And seeing sort of each one of those points of entry, sort of seeing the physical manifestations of the political decisions that people make. So, in other words, the infrastructures that we create around us, and becoming increasingly aware of those infrastructures and how they affected my daily world, I guess. So that's sort of how it started, I think.
Great. Your new work is very political, and I was just generally, how can poetry act politically, or, you know, be a form of political action?
Yeah, it is much more overtly political, I think, this book. And it is probably more overtly political than I'm comfortable with, on the one hand, but also I feel it had to be as politically overt as it is. The time that it was written was a time when people were not talking about political issues that were right in front of their noses. And it was a very kind of terrifying time. It was post 9/11, it was the end of the Bush era, and it was a very frustrating time. Even when people started to talk about what was going on, they were very reluctant to see the connection between the problems that they were talking about, and I know I'm being vague, but the sort of political problems that they were talking about and how they might impact on their daily choices in their own lives, and choices even in terms of how they move through the city, whether they take the expressway, whether indeed they drive. So you could be marching against oil, but to get to the march, you're taking your car and you're paying your toll. And you're part of the system.
Right. So what kind of change do you think that poetry can produce or affect?
Well, I think poetry, poetry has, I think of Neruda, and you can think of someone less directly affecting change, someone like Paul Celan, or you can think of someone like Allen Ginsberg, coming out and, you know, just glorifying the asshole in America at a time when that was just not done. If you look at what was being written at the time when Howl was first written, it has enormous potential to move people. So, yes, poetry is political, whether or not people want to own up to the fact that what they're writing is political and has political ramifications. It is very political, so it can move. It can move very explicitly, or it can be more subtle, I think, like someone like Paul Celan or Mahmoud Darwish, who is huge in the Middle Eastern world, and most North Americans don't know who he is at all.
Okay, so maybe you could talk a little bit about the type of actual change that you'd like to see, the type of things that you're addressing in your poetry. You know, subtly or directly, sort of the general direction that you'd like to see our society go in the next 10, 20, 50 years.
Okay. Well, I think more than anything, what I hoped to happen with all my writing, actually, but particularly with Expressway, is simply to make people aware of the choices that they are making. We are a sum of all of our choices. Every day, every hour, every minute, every second, we are making a choice. And every choice that we make is supporting something, whether it's to walk a certain way or make a certain purchase or support a certain or not say anything, whatever. They're all choices and they're all creating our world. So Expressway really wants people to stop and think about those choices that they're doing. And, you know, it's not really, I mean, there is a section in here where I start to try and imagine other possibilities. I'm always interested in other possibilities because, again, I'm very aware that where we are is the sum of our choices, and that we could have made other choices, and that we can always, again, make new choices. So yes, things like tearing down the Gardiner or the other in Boston, they tore down. I can't remember the name of the highway, but again, a road system that cut the city off from the harbor and really just cut off neighborhoods. So what would it be like to make a different choice? You know, what would it be like to rethink the idea of the personal mobility device, also known as the car? what would that be like to have electric cars, to have tires made out of material that's more quiet, or roads, as I suggest in the book, made out of romance novels? That's actually true. Somebody did do that, pulped romance novels and made a road. I don't think that anything is firm, and I think everything can be rethought. And I think usually people make choices in terms of what's easiest for the market, not what's best for our society. And I think that the whole notion of the infrastructure is about doing away with the local and making people forget the implications of those choices that they're making. If you can pay $2 more and zoom by the local and all of its problems, you actually don't have much relationship to that. And studies have shown, actually, that there is a particular relationship between familiarity with a neighborhood and the speed a given car will be going, for example. So there are very real implications. And if you pick up your phone and you want to call the storage facility at the end of your block, and you end up calling India, then what does that say about the relationship between you and even your block? So I wonder what would be wrong with saying, I believe probably that I would like a shorter distance between myself and my storage facility at the end of my block. So there are implications to that kind of thinking, and they're very immediate. And I think it has to do about distances and bypassing and being able to move without any connection to the place that you are moving from and to.
All of your work, and this one too, is very kind of stylistically or formally experimental. And I was just wondering if you could maybe go in a little bit about how the formal experimentation contributed to political expression, or was a political act even.
Well, it's experimental because poetry can be very normative, and discussions around poetry can be very normative. It can be very dismissive of any kind of political content. It can be very dismissive about any kind of formal play. And it's far too easy to just say, you know, this is the avant-garde writing, this is an experimental poem, we don't have to take it seriously. Serious poetry is formal poetry. It's arranged in verses, and it has a certain kind of language and a certain kind of lyric subjectivity to it, a speaking subject. Expressway, in a sense, takes issue with that. It often will give the same information in a sort of more traditional lyric voice. It give the poet or the reader the sort of tercets and the kind of very normative language that sort of a certain kind of readership wants. And then in the next section, it'll take that and it'll give it a radical treatment. It'll give it in run-on sentences. It'll give it in the form of a Google search, you know, some of the text that's been sculpted from, basically from our subconscious, which is what, in a way, Google represents. So it's asking, in a way, how people can take in information and how people can be accepting or not accepting of different points of view, and how those different points of view appear on a page or in your ear as it is now.
Right. So then it's almost as if the argument is being repeated in different formats. And is it modified at all, the argument that you're making throughout the different poems?
It's not really modified. It's, you know, it's in the Steiningen way, it's repetition and difference. That each time it's repeated, it's slightly different. What I find interesting is that most critics are unable to accept the book wholesale, right? They say, well, they can accept this part, but they can't accept that part. And it really is, it does reveal the biases of the person writing the review. Because if you are coming to the book with an open mind, you can look at the book for what it does. If you're coming to the book to see it as a reflection of what you think poetry is, you can only be happy with half of it, at the very most.
Thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Testing, 1, 2, 3. There we go. Okay, great. So the story I want to read, right, I want to read a section from a story that's giving me a lot of trouble right now, and I'm not sure if I like it or not. There are definitely bits and pieces of the story that I really like, but I'm having a lot of trouble dealing with it because it features a character who I don't particularly like and who I don't particularly understand. And I think it's really important to write about characters who you dislike and who confuse you. And I'm really trying to force myself to write about characters that I'm uncomfortable with. On the other hand, it's very hard to do because I'm often putting this character into situations and I can't, it's not intuitive to me. I can't figure out how he would respond to these situations. It's also difficult because I find it a little bit depressing to write about a character who I really don't like. And I find it a little bit alienating to write about somebody who I don't sort of connect with. So what's interesting about this character is that he's an observer of people. He loves to sit and watch people, and he sort of commits their features to memory. But he doesn't particularly like people. He doesn't relate to people well. And the story sort of traces, it starts with him as a younger character in the schoolyard, and then it goes through to sort of middle age. And the section I want to read is from when he's in his early 30s, and it involves a sort of short relationship that he has. And it's a section that I like quite a lot, even though I'm not entirely sure how it fits into the rest of the story or where the rest of the story is going. So hopefully by next week I will have a better version of the story to read out loud. But until then, I'm just going to read this section. So his name is Sonny, and he's on a date with a woman named Terry. As he spoke with Terry, he observed her face, the dull arc of her eyebrows, the tiny crater below the nose, probably a remnant of acne or chicken pox, the slender, tentative smile. When she told him to stop staring at her, he chuckled behind his glass of beer. "It's funny," he said. "You're not the first person to say that to me." Later that night, he got up from the bed where she slept beside him and passed through the narrow hallway and into the living room. The place was sparsely decorated. There were only two pictures on the walls, and the bookshelves were half empty. He had a sense that the room had been purged of memories, that all symbols of a past happiness had been expelled, and there wasn't enough material left to cover the walls or to fill the bookcases. He felt strongly that he didn't belong in her home, that it wasn't a right to allow his solitude to collide with hers. They met twice a week for the next month, at brightly lit soba shops with long trestle tables and cozy pubs where electro music clashed with nostalgic decor. Their conversations converged on the same topics, the futility of work, family reunions, or politics, the way pop music had become less innocent since they'd come of age, their mutual preference for sitcoms over reality TV. Sometimes she mentioned sex and how much she'd missed it. She told him that she'd read once about how the human eye, when exposed to prolonged periods of darkness, became incapable of processing light, and she feared that years of abstinence might have a similar effect on a person's capacity for pleasure. This frank expression of longing seemed crude and slightly sickening to Sunny. She also talked frequently about the loneliness of the past 3 years, and Sunny sensed the burden that these words placed on him. He didn't know how to break up another person's isolation. The best he could do was intrude on it. He decided that night that he no longer wanted to see her. The next morning, he sat alone in his car, watching passers-by, imagining that he was a private investigator and that everything he looked at was evidence for a case. He wondered if there was a way to make use of all the details he'd observed and committed to memory, if a lifetime's worth of twitches, coat collars, and lopsided mouths could contribute to a better understanding of people, could explain why they fascinated and repulsed him.
That was Simon Lucen reading from one of his short stories. Make sure to check out that reading on November 26th. It's in the basement of Thompson House at 8 p.m. And don't forget to pick up a copy of the Daily Lit Sup out on Monday. Before that, on Saturday, November 21st, there's going to be a reading with excerpts from the upcoming literary supplement at Arts Cafe at 201 Fairmount West, corner of Esplanade, that starts at 8 p.m. And there's a $3 donation at the door. All the proceeds go to an independent refugee publication in Kenya. That's all for this week. Thanks so much for listening to Unfit to Print, and make sure to check us out next week.
Are you ready for the sound experience of a lifetime? Are you ready for crystal clarity in sonic bliss? Are you ready for CKUT? We're ready for you. 90.3 on your FM dial.
You just heard this week's edition of Unfit to Print coming from the Miguel Daily. The next edition of Unfit to Print will be airing next Tuesday between 5 and 6. Right now it's 22 past 5, and up next we'll be hearing news about the campaign surrounding the hydroelectric project envisioned for the Romaine River in northern Quebec. On October 23rd, activists from Alliance Romaine returned to Montreal after completing a series of marathons spanning 1,500 kilometers across Quebec to raise awareness and political will in opposition to a hydroelectric project that they say will endanger the Romaine River. Tom from CKUT's Community News Collective brings us an interview with Chris Scott of the Alliance Romaine, who ran across Quebec as part of this campaign. Stay tuned.
To speak about the mobilization of the Honduran people, we've contacted Steve Stewart. Steve is the program director for the Vancouver-based solidarity organization Co-Development Canada. He was part of an international delegation to Honduras from September 5th to 11th, and so has had firsthand experience of developments in that country. Good morning, Steve, and welcome to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio.
Bonjour, bonsoir, c'est Geneviève Letarte. Vous écoutez EQT, CKUT, 90.3 FM à Montréal. Ça, c'est fort.
And that was just an interview that will be airing later on the show. Right now, this is Tom's interview with Chris Scott of Alliance Romaine.
Hi, my name is Tom, and I'm here with Chris Scott, who's a member of Alliance Romaine, a grassroots organization opposing the construction of four dams on the Romaine River. He is the organizer of 50 marathons that took place during September 9th and October 18th, starting in James Bay, a James Bay town of Matagami, and ending finally when the runners reached the Romaine River. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, pleasure. Hi there, Tom. Hi, everyone.
What was the aim of this marathon?
Really, the goal of the marathon was to connect, to actually draw a line between two big rivers in Quebec, the Rupert River, which flows into James Bay in northwestern Quebec, and the Romaine River, which is about a two-day drive east of here on the North Shore. And really, the goal was to show that in the same year, Quebec is losing two of its largest and wildest rivers to hydroelectric dams. There are about 16 large rivers in the province, 17 if you include the St. Lawrence, And in the last few decades, all but two or three of those have already been dammed. The Rupert River is a river that is being diverted as we speak into a hydroelectric reservoir by Hydro-Quebec. So it's a project to produce more hydroelectricity that will flood an area two times the size of Montreal Island. And I had gone up as an interested citizen, really, to James Bay a couple years ago to talk to some of the Cree elders about how they felt about losing trap land, about having the forest flooded, about losing their way of life to the damming. And it obviously wasn't the first river that they were seeing lost in this way. And around the same time I was talking with them about the Rupert River, we found out that in exactly the totally the other end of the province, the Romaine River, one of the largest and wildest rivers left in eastern Quebec that actually flows into a national park, mm-hmm. Is also being dammed. They're also planning to put four dams on it. So we're saying enough is enough. I mean, hydroelectricity may have seemed like a green form of energy in the past, but we have newer and cleaner technologies now, and that's what we should be using and developing rather than damming our last rivers.
So what about these newer and cleaner technologies? What kind of programs would you suggest?
One thing we do point out, and we think there are technological fixes, including wind energy, including solar energy, tide energy, biomass. There are all sorts of technologies that are available that are underdeveloped in Quebec at this point. But we also want to point out that Quebecers are actually... They consume far more electricity than they need to. There's a lot of waste in the way that we transmit electricity. A lot is lost on the transmission lines and in the way we consume electricity. We often use electricity to heat our houses in the winter, but we don't insulate our houses the way that we could. So a lot of that heat and therefore a lot of the electricity is lost. Quebecers actually consume twice as much electricity per capita as Ontarians, twice more times than Ontarians. So we're saying that if we want to take some of the billions of dollars that the Quebec government is throwing at a project like the Romaine, we're talking about an $8 billion project, which is supposed to last over 10 years. Mm-hmm. If we were to take a similar time frame and a similar amount of money and invest that in encouraging people to reduce their energy consumption, we could already make up more energy than they're planning to get by damming the Romaine. So we're both for energy conservation, and once we've already done that, and once we actually are using the energy that we do make efficiently, we could look into new technologies, primarily wind and solar.
Yeah, I think we've been a bit spoiled almost, by the amount of electricity that hydro brings in.
Yeah, I mean, we've been told kind of just, you know, turn the tap on or whatever. We've just been told it's clean energy. We've been told that we have so much of it that it'll never run out. And that's just not true. We're about to run out of freshwater rivers to dam. Whether they do manage to dam another couple of rivers like the Romaine or not, we're soon going to be in a position where we won't really have that many rivers left to dam. So if we want to continue producing electricity to meet this overconsumption, at some point we're going to run out. And the only question is, do we run out or do we decide to change course while we still have some free-flowing rivers in Quebec that we can benefit from in terms of the support they give to the ecosystems, in terms of the recreational value, in terms of the sheer beauty of these rivers, or not? So, you know, hopefully we'll have enough wisdom as a society to change course now while we can still avoid the worst.
Yeah. But how is the damming affecting the river itself? You know, I assume it's killing wildlife.
Yeah, well, I'll take an example of the Romaine River, since it's the one we're focusing on. They're planning to put four dams on the Romaine River over the next 10 years, really. And every time they put a dam in a river, they're basically creating a reservoir. They're flooding a lot of the forest around the river, and this is used as a basin of water that can be brought over the dam at different speeds to produce electricity. And obviously when you flood a large area of boreal forest, you're destroying the habitat for many cases endangered species that tend to congregate and live near the valley bottoms where the rivers flow. So you're destroying habitat. It's not, in the case of the Romaine River, it's 279 square kilometers, so more than half the size of Montreal Island. You're also destroying the flow of oxygen, because normal rivers, when they flow and go over a series of rapids, they take a lot of the oxygen that's in the air, just because they're all this interface between the air and the water, and mix that oxygen into the river, and eventually this oxygen-rich water flows out, in the case of the Romaine, into the national park. It's actually a national park on the mouth of the Romaine River, where it enters the St. Lawrence. So you're having all this oxygen-rich water, which is very productive for marine life, and you're also having all this these nutrients, which are often come originally from the forest, from the topsoil in the forest that seep into the river and that are brought by the river downstream, again feeding all the rich marine life in the national park. And when you put dams in the river, you're basically changing the pattern of that flow. The nutrients and the oxygen either don't go downstream or don't go downstream at the same rate and at the same time in the same seasons that they previously did. So basically that, all those building blocks, the oxygen and the nutrients which are necessary for marine life, everything from phytoplankton up the food chain, aren't there anymore. So everything downstream becomes a much more impoverished and marine environment. What that means is fish don't grow as big because there's not as much for them to eat. That many species that previously lived there will become rare or extinct from that particular area. And this obviously affects both the quality of the marine life in the park. It also affects fishing and the full fishing industry, and that's an important source of employment for people on the North Shore. So there are all sorts of environmental effects, including obviously mercury contamination. Essentially, the species, the biodiversity, the ecosystems that are in a river before the dam are not going to be there after the dam. And we've seen this through like 30 and 40 years of disappointments in the James Bay projects. The Cree that used to make a living as hunters and trappers off that land are basically now living in villages without anything to do. I mean, yes, they do get some compensation, but they're basically living off the checks and aren't able to live an active life anymore, and they certainly regret what's happened. So the actual purpose of our marathon was to take a written message from one of the social workers in the Cree communities that had seen what had been happening over the last 40 years with the damming of one river after another on Cree territory, and he wanted this message to be relayed as a warning to the Innu, the First Nation that has its traditional territory near the Romaine, and to warn them not to let the same thing happen to them. And hopefully that message actually was delivered to the chief of an Innu village called Equinici at the end of the marathon. We hope that the message will be listened to.
But now that it's delivered, I mean, what can they do to prevent like further damming of such rivers, you know?
I think there are several things they could do. The first thing that the Innu and also people on the North Shore can do is to speak up. And they have been doing that. Recently, there was a meeting in Quebec City to discuss basically the Plan Nord, a development plan for the North Shore region with the Minister of the Environment and so on. And several of the Cree villages, including Equinici, were invited and said, we're not coming because essentially we're disappointed with the way you've been developing resources in our area. So even making their objections clear in public is a first step. Beyond that, we obviously, as a society, need to have a culture where information is discussed more publicly, where the number of rivers that they're planning to dam are at least listed beforehand, so we're not just taken by surprise when they say, hey, we want to dam one more river. But specifically, there are going to have to be pressure tactics, including boycotts, perhaps, of Hydro-Québec, including going to potential consumers of Hydro-Québec in the United States, state utilities, companies there that would be buying Hydro-Québec's electricity and encouraging them to cancel or to not to sign new contracts with Hydro-Québec. There have to be a whole series of pressure tactics, both within Quebec and outside of Quebec, to say this is dirty energy and we're not interested in having it or in taking it any longer.
Mm-hmm. And going back to the marathon itself, can I ask how many people took part?
Yeah, we had actually mostly runners. So people were running, and generally they would prepare to run a 42-kilometer leg, which is the length of a marathon. And we had 28 people actually run, or in a few cases walk, the distance. So relaying, one person would carry the message starting from Batagami, next past the baton, the message that I mentioned, written by the Cree trapper, on to the next person, and this would go all the way to the North Shore. And a few people even ran or walked twice. So we had 28 people, and this went over a period of 6 weeks. But obviously, we couldn't have done this if it had just been the runners. We had people who gave us logistical support, people who let us stay at their places for free, people who helped us financially, people who put on a street theater, a skit, when we were in Quebec City, which was performed in front of the National Assembly. People who drove the vehicle, who lent us a vehicle, you know. So we really had probably at least 100 people sort of involved in putting this thing together. Mm-hmm. And they often say that if one person like takes the time to write a letter to your MP, it's supposed to mean there are so many people who feel the same way and just haven't had the time or the opportunity to write the letter. Imagine people who practice to run a marathon, or someone who even just takes time to let a marathon or a group of people stay in their house. That's a lot more of an investment than just writing a letter. So presumably, that's about 10 times more this number, that quota of people. It means we really have like a large percent of the population which is behind us, which is fed up with seeing their rivers gutted one by one, and would really feel that we should, it's time to take some of that $8 billion, some of this enormous expense that they're putting in these archaic, you know, damaging type of projects, and actually invest them in smart technology. And it's time to say that the province doesn't belong to Jean Charest. The province doesn't belong to Hydro-Québec. The province belongs to the people, to the generations that will be around when people who are Mr. Charest's age will be long gone. And it's our responsibility to stand up and make a fuss until we can get control back over our resources and over the energy policy in this province.
I think the answer lies more in conservation instead of just saying, oh, here you go, here's some more energy, you know, so we can, because it's good for now, but, you know, what are we going to do once it's...
one way or the other thing we learn on this planet, we're dealing with finite resources. At a certain point, you know, a lot of these economists, like presumably Mr. Charest, people kind of conservative, they talk a lot about living within the budget, about having a balanced budget when it comes to money, but they don't seem to think about having a balanced budget when it comes to ecology, when it comes to our natural resources, our natural capital that we're living off of. I mean, if you spend faster than you're getting, essentially, sooner or later, you are going to run out, and that's what we're doing now with our energy consumption patterns. Mm-hmm. And someone like Monsieur Charest, I don't know how old he is, he's 60, 65. You know, he's not necessarily going to be around when we go off the cliff environmentally. But you know, some of the people listening to us are going to be around, and obviously, I mean, some old people definitely, I mean, are aware of this. I'm not trying to make this a generational thing, but Monsieur Charest obviously like grew up in the 1950s, when he just thought that like limitless growth was the way to go, and he wasn't aware, and people his generation, at least in school, weren't made aware of the fact that we're living on a small planet with finite resources that are going to run out. And if we're going to be smart, and if we're going to make this planet, you know, livable for 500 years from now, we have to start thinking in the long term. We can't go on this spending spree of let's dam all our rivers, let's pump all the oil out of the ground, you know, let's consume as if there's no tomorrow. There is a tomorrow, and we have to smarten up and live within our ecological means. And we have the option of doing that and still having quite a decent standard of living. And Mr. Charest and his old school of thinking are really an obstacle to that.
Yeah, I think people really have to change their way of thinking, you know?
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
And some people are, and like definitely when we were on the North Shore, we were like pleasantly surprised. We often thought before I really got there that people on the North Shore would be sort of very attached to industry, kind of very blue collar, and that's it. Mm-hmm. And I found that a lot of people on the North Shore, as I say, they cared for their rivers. Even, you know, people that are moose hunting for the season, mm-hmm. they would stop and congratulate us, and the people in the youth hostel that we met were very supportive. So a lot of people are really, really supportive of our message. And that was one of the real successes of the marathon. We got a certain amount of media attention, and we got a lot of contacts locally. And we're going to be going back next year, and if necessary, the year after, to meet with some of those contacts, meet with people that are maybe fighting to protect another river on the North Shore, but that are aware that the North Shore is really a superb ecosystem, a beautiful wild open space that live there by choice, that either decided to move there or decided to stay there if they're born there. And we're going to be working with them and trying to figure out the best way we can fight this government and fight this policy and get some real conservation happening.
All right. Well, good luck with that.
Thank you very much. We'll keep you posted.
Yeah, please do. And thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. And I hope you and some of the listeners get out to see the Romaine yourself, because it's a really spectacular river, and seeing is believing. It's a salmon stream. It flows into a national park. It's great for kayaking. It's really a spectacular place to see. And I it's my dearest wish that some of you will get out to see that before it's too late.
Yeah, so once again, I'm talking to Chris Scott, and my name is Tom. You've been listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
Thanks.
It is currently 5:40, and you're still listening to Off the Hour on CKUT 90.3 FM. You just heard an interview with Chris Scott of Alliance Romaine, who is part of a campaign against the hydroelectric project envisioned for the Romaine River in northern Quebec. Stay tuned, because coming up next, we'll be hearing an interview with Steve Stewart, who spent several days in Honduras in September. Stay tuned.
For the first time on the stages of Montreal's Centaur Theatre, performer and director Marie Brassard presents Jimmy, her evocative solo show about dreams and desire, from November 25th to 29th. The story of a homosexual hairdresser who comes to life in the dream of a homophobic American general, Jimmy is a beautifully haunting tour de force about longing and loneliness. Frozen in a moment of pure pleasure, Jimmy tries to escape the logic of the dreams that imprison him so he can finally find his way back to his lost love. Jimmy runs from November 25th to 29th at the Centaur Theatre, located at 453 Saint-François-Xavier. For tickets, call 514-288-3161. For more information, visit infrarouge.org. Jimmy is a CKUT co-presentation.
Monday, and Thursday.
Look for the McGill Daily
in Shatner,
McConnell,
Leacock,
Arts,
and numerous other locations.
Read about news,
culture,
commentary,
and letters.
Read it in class,
while riding your bike,
while taking a shower,
or while having sex.
And best of all, it's free.
You can also listen to the Daily's weekly broadcast Tuesdays after 5 here on CKUT.
Honduran President Manuel Zelaya was forced into exile following a military coup in June. He staged a return to Honduras on September 21st, when thousands of Honduras defied the coup regime's order and gathered in front of the Brazilian embassy in Tegucigalpa, where Zelaya was in refuge. Coming up next, we'll hear an interview with Steve Stewart, who spent several days on Honduras in September. In the following segment, we hear Stewart's interview with the Red Eye Show on Vancouver's CFRO radio.
To speak about the mobilization of the Honduran people, we've contacted Steve Stewart. Steve is the program director for the Vancouver-based solidarity organization Co-Development Canada. He was part of an international delegation to Honduras from September 5th to 11th, and so has had firsthand experience of developments in that country. Good morning, Steve, and welcome to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio.
Good morning. Thank you, Hugh, for inviting me.
How extensive are the popular mobilizations against the coup?
They were, while I was down there, quite extensive. I was there from the 5th to the 11th of September, and at that time there was it's a bit of a lull in the level of repression, in that there'd been heavy crackdowns in August, and it sort of eased off a bit until last week. But we ended up participating in one march that wasn't huge. It was on maybe 5,000 people, but still fairly large. It went on for hours and hours, and we thought that was sort of, you know, we were lucky to have arrived on the day that there was a march. We found out the next day that was just their daily march in Tegucigalpa, that every single day they had a similar march going to different parts of the city. And we found out later still from others in other cities that these marches went on daily in many of the cities in the country.
I had heard at some point that there were, in addition to marches, people blockading roads and, in a sense, putting a stall to some of the economic activity of the country. Is there truth to that?
In August, there was a lot of roadblocks. They were very violently repressed. There was a lot of people injured, many people jailed, thousands of people jailed, and a number of people killed. That sort of forced a change of tactics on the part of the protesters. However, a lot of the sort of hindrance with the economic activities has been carried out by the coup government itself, because when there are large mobilizations, they shut down the airports, close the borders, block the roads themselves to prevent protesters from getting to the capital. Many people come from their villages into town. So quite often, all you need to do is march and you shut down all the economic activity because the army sets up the roadblocks.
When there are these demonstrations in different parts of the country or even in the city, are they coordinated, or is there kind of a unified organization which tries to decide on tactics that they think will be most effective, or is it quite spontaneous and uncoordinated?
No, since the day after the coup, sort of coalition was created called the National Resistance Front Against the Coup, which is sort of known by everyone in Honduras simply as the Resistance. It started originally kind of ad hoc, made up of a sort of coordination of representatives of the major organizations, the Campesino movement, the indigenous peoples, the women, the youth. Each one sort of had their section. While we were there, we attended the formal founding of the Resistance Front, which brought in about 500 delegates from all 18 of the provinces, and they spend a great deal of time debating the structures and decision-making process. And by the end of that assembly, they had sort of created a national organization that was there for the long haul. In some ways, Micheletes let the genie out of the bottle when he carried out the coup, in that Honduras will not go back to the way it was, whether or not the coup ends or not. The Resistance Front is looking to refund the country, or refound the country, pardon me.
Maybe that brings up to mind then, what kind of goals or demands are these popular mobilizations struggling for?
Well, the original motivation, or at least the excuse given by the coup leaders for carrying out the coup, was that Zelaya was holding a sort of public opinion poll about whether people were in favor of adding a referendum to the November 29th general elections to ask people if they wanted to create a constituent assembly to write a new constitution for the country. Since the coup, it's become sort of much more polarized in the country and class lines much more clearly defined. And so the demands that you see everywhere, painted everywhere, and in the chants of the marchers, is to go straight to a constituent assembly. It's kind of with Zelaya or without Zelaya. What they want is to immediately elect a constituent assembly that will write a new constitution for the country.
And is this seems to be part of a tactic that began in Venezuela and Bolivia and Ecuador, where people reconstruct their constitutions in ways that allow for greater participation and more social progressive changes. Is that the sort of inspiration for Honduras as well?
Yeah, the current Honduran constitution was written under the military dictatorship in the early 80s, and so it doesn't contemplate much participation on the part of the population. And people have been inspired by seeing the sort of shifts in the power balance after the constituent assemblies in Ecuador, Bolivia, and Venezuela, and hope that if they hold this create a new constitution that it may lead them in the same direction. That's also what the people who carried out the coup fear, is that if they open it up to the people to rewrite it, the rules would change a lot.
You referred earlier to repression from the army and police. How would you characterize that repression? Is it an effort to really gun down masses of people to prevent or destroy the momentum? Is it something that comes more intensely at some moments and then backs off and so on? What sort of strategy is are the coup makers pursuing, if there is any consistent strategy?
It has come in waves. Initially, the repression was more selective. But when it was clear there was such a huge upswell of hundreds of thousands of people in the streets calling for the return of Zelaya, it has tended to be accelerated at certain times. Generally, when Zelaya has attempted to return, thousands of people have mobilized to support him, and that's when the crackdowns have been hardest. The most dangerous period, I believe, was when President Zelaya, surprisingly, at least for the